Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Coming to you from the hills, looking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of our friend Ralph Epperson, who's been really studying the Masonic movement and the influence of Masonry in America. Well, pretty close to, what is it, 30 years now, Ralph? How long have you been studying this?
I started in the 60s.
In the 60s, so it's close to 40 years,
yeah,
then, isn't it?
40 years.
All right, fine. Well, I've known Ralph probably for 30 years, and he's always certainly been faithful. He's given his life to really developing ideas on Masonry, writing books about it. We carry three of his books, The New World Order. We carry his book on the Masonry, the Conspiracy Against Christianity, and The Unseen Hand. And then he's written a couple of other books, and I'll let him tell you about that later on. But Ralph is going to be speaking at the Conspiracy Conference this coming weekend. That's going to be held up at the Marriott Conference Center in Santa Clara. That's the Marriott Hotel there. It's all day Saturday, all day Sunday. I'm not speaking. I do have a table there, and I'll be there on Sunday, although Steve, who works with me, will be there Saturday. But if you're interested in knowing anything more about this conference, the number to call is 925-449-6844. That's 925-449-6844. And I will tell you that this is the best lineup of speakers I've seen. They have Jim Mars, who's a frequent guest here, Joyce Riley, Ralph Epperson, of course, is with it, Clifford Conacorm, who talks on chemtrails, and really half a dozen other very, very good speakers. I was quite impressed with the lineup. Ralph, are you looking forward to being here?
Oh, yes, absolutely, Dr. Stan. This is a great opportunity and a great honor. I was honored and very pleased that I was invited, and I accepted as soon as I got a chance to speak.
All right, Norris, Barry Shamish is going to be there as well, so we'll have a good time. Anyway, you go right ahead. Now, what are we going to talk about tonight, Ralph?
Well, Dr. Stan, I think it might be appropriate to let your listeners know what I'll be talking about that Sunday. I'll be speaking at Sunday, 9 o'clock, and I got an hour and a half to present a three-hour DVD that I produced. And I think that'd be appropriate. If you wish to do this, let's talk about that.
You go right ahead.
Let your listeners know what I'll be talking about Sunday.
Ralph is going to be talking about no nukes but U.S. nukes or something of that sort. The general theme is that the United States is the only country that has nuclear weapons. Would that be a fair statement?
Yeah, I put out a DVD called No Nukes But U.S. Nukes, and I've updated it, and now it's called Only the United States Has Nukes. And I want you to understand, Dr. Stan, I know this is contrary to everything that we're taught. The media, the government, governments, plural, are telling us they've got nuclear weapons, and I'm trying to tell you, Dr. Stan, it's simply not true.
All right, well, I'm going to let you go ahead here, and I'm not going to say anything. I'm not sure that I agree, but I'm always fascinated by what you have to say, and who knows, maybe you'll convince me. So you go ahead and explain why only the United States has nukes, and certainly everything we think we know about the nuclear threat is just non-existent. So you go ahead, and for our listeners, I'm neither endorsing nor not endorsing what Ralph has to say. We're going to learn together. So you go right ahead.
Well, Dr. Stan, let's start with this. You and I both, I believe, agree that there is a conspiracy at work in this world.
There absolutely is.
Okay, I have spent 40-some years of my life researching this. I've read over 1,000 books, countless articles and tapes and DVDs and videos, etc., to prove that there is a conspiracy. And I'd like to start briefly by just mentioning Bill Clinton, because he told us on live national television back in 1992 that he, too, was a conspiracy theorist. Conspiracy realist, not a theorist. He admitted there was a conspiracy.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. Oh, Ralph, go right ahead. Of course, you're speaking of her there on July 4th.
Clinton told us in 1992 at the Democratic Convention that he was aware there was a conspiracy at work and that conspiracy controlled communism, often cooperated with communism. It controlled both political parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, equally. And that means that there, he was admitting there was a conspiracy, and obviously he had gone to work for it, and they had made him president of the United States. And I cover that in my three-hour DVD to show you how he became president.
Now, of course, basically what he did, he certainly named Professor Carroll Quigley as one of his teachers, a man he looked to, for source of information. And, of course, Professor Quigley had written a book called Tragedy and Hope that lays out essentially the theme that you've espoused.
Yes. Now, that book was required reading, we know that for certain, of Dr. Quigley's courses while Bill Clinton was a student there. Clinton went there from 64 to 68, and the book was written in 1966. And during my DVD, I show you an article from the Georgetown magazine, the alumni magazine, and in there it says that in the 25th anniversary of Clinton's graduation, it says that he was that the book Tragedy and Hope was required reading for. So we know that Bill Clinton read Tragedy and Hope. Dr. Quigley was his major professor. He majored in foreign service, and that's the field that Dr. Quigley was the head of the department. So we know that he read the book. And in that book, Quigley states that there is a conspiracy. He called it an international Anglophile network that's been in operation, he claimed, for over a generation, probably since about, I think, back in the 1920s or so. And he pointed out that they controlled both parties equally, and they controlled the economies of the world. That's what their goal was. He cited the name of Cecil Rhodes as being a member of this conspiracy, and Cecil Rhodes created the Rhodes Scholarship Program with his enormous wealth, and that's where Bill Clinton went after Georgetown University. He went to Oxford on a Rhodes Scholarship. Now, one of the mentors that he didn't praise during that speech in 1992 was Senator William Fulbright, the Democrat from Arkansas. Now, Fulbright was not only a former Rhodes Scholar, but he was also a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. And I believe it was Fulbright who urged Clinton to go to Georgetown to be taught by Dr. Quigley, and then ultimately go to Oxford on a Rhodes Scholarship. And that's exactly what he did. And then in 1988, when little Billy Clinton came back home, he joined the Council on Foreign Relations. It's just exactly as...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Ralph is simply pointing out that when Bill Clinton gave his acceptance speech on the 14th of July of the year 1992 to the Democratic nomination, when he accepted the Democratic nomination for the presidency, he talked about his relationship with Professor Carroll Quigley. Professor Carroll Quigley had written a book called Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, where he talked about the fact that there is a group that rules the world. He called them the International Anglophile Network. Traced them back to a man named Cecil Rhodes, pointed out that the Rhodes Scholarships and the Council on Foreign Relations are really one of the driving or major forces in the United States. And certainly that Bill Clinton understood this. Professor Quigley had encouraged Bill Clinton to go to Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar, which he did. And, of course, when he came back, what did Bill Clinton do but join the Council on Foreign Relations, which is America's invisible government. Our Secretary of State always comes from there. Our Chairman of the Federal Reserve System always comes from there. Our Director of the CIA almost always comes from there. I mean, this couldn't happen by accident over a 50-year period unless, of course, there was something or some force guiding our society. So pick up the story there, Ralph.
Yes, that's... And by the way, you can read the speech in which that Clinton delivered. It's in his book entitled Putting People First, starting on page 217, and then on page 231, he cites the two names as being Dr. Carroll Quigley and John Kennedy, who got him into politics.
Okay.
I asked you this question the last time I was on the air, Dr. Stan, and I'll ask it again because it's the next one that follows. Let's just presume, Dr. Stan, that you are the president of a national corporation, huge corporation with branch offices all over the United States. And it's your corporation, you own it, you're the principal executive officer, and you run it. And let's say that you hear from a reliable source, maybe your cousin that works in Pittsburgh, Let's just say that he calls you and says, Dr. Stan, the branch manager here in Pittsburgh has told me he wants to kill you and take over your corporation. Now, what do you do? And I'll answer the question just to save time. Obviously, what you do is you fly to Pittsburgh, go into the office of your Pittsburgh branch manager and say, I understand you want to kill me, and you give him a gun to do so. Is that right?
Well, I wouldn't give him a gun to kill me, that's for sure.
Let's go back. If this conspiracy runs the world, that means that the Pittsburgh branch manager, it works for you.
Right.
Works for the conspiracy. Now, why would you arm him with nuclear weapons if he wants to kill you? We've been told for 70 or 80 years the Russians want to nuke us. Why would we allow the branch manager in that nation to have nuclear weapons that he could use against you?
I'm sure what you're going is the fact that it was the United States government, it was Harry Hopkins, worked for the president, who actually sent the plans for the nuclear bomb, the Manhattan Project, to the Russians during the Second World War, that it certainly, we at that time sent them the material to build the bombs, we sent them the material to know how to build the bombs, we sent them the deuterium and heavy water and the nuclear material they needed to build a bomb, and that's an excellent question. Why were we bombing, why were we actually providing the Soviets with the material they needed to build nuclear weapons? It just doesn't make sense, does it?
No, but let's finish, Dr. Stan. It wasn't Harry Hopkins. Harry Hopkins took orders from Franklin Roosevelt. Franklin Roosevelt's son, James Roosevelt, wrote a book entitled A Family Matter. I think it was in 1985 or 99. I've forgotten the year. But you can read that book because the son of Franklin Roosevelt wrote it, and in there he details how he was ordered by his father, Franklin Roosevelt, Commander-in-Chief, that James was a major in the Army, and his father called him into Washington, D.C., and said, I want you to turn over the atomic bomb to Russia. Now, that means that he was in charge. He's the one that told Harry Hopkins how to do it, and that's what happened. Now, let's go back. That was done in 1943 and 44. In 1952, the United States government charged the Rosenbergs, Ethel and Julius, a man and wife partnership, with giving or selling or somehow trading the secrets of the atomic bomb to Russia. And they tried them and convicted them in a jury, and when the judge sentenced them, he said, you are guilty of a betrayal of your nation, and this treason is going to cost millions, has the potential to cost millions of lives, and you're the ones that did that. Now, the question is, when were Franklin and James Roosevelt charged with treason and betrayal? Dr. Stan, do you remember?
No, because they weren't. It was the point you're making, that they actually supervised the handing over the secrets of the atomic bomb to the Russians, but the average American has never heard that story.
That's correct.
And incidentally, the story is told in a book called From Major Jordan's Diary. Major Jordan was the man who observed what was happening and wrote about it from Major Jordan's Diary. And, of course, this other book, of course, it's a family... A Matter by James Roosevelt. Sounds like a fascinating book I should have in my library as well.
I would urge you to read it, because what it does is confirms Major Jordan. I just found an article, I was flipping through some old files of mine, that Major Jordan wrote about this thing, and he says that he was talking to a friend of his, and his friend said, you need to talk to Senator Stiles Bridges, who was, a senator at the time. This was back in the 70s, I guess. And so he met Senator Stiles, and he gave him... Major Jordan gave him the outline of what he had talked about and some evidence, and the first thing out of Senator Stiles' mouth is, have you ever been admitted to a mental institution? Now, this is called investigative research. You see, right away, the first thing is, you don't care about his credentials and his documentation. You claim he's a lunatic. And that's what happened until J. Fulton Lewis got hold of the story, and he made it nationwide and went with it for months, and that opened up congressional investigations. Now, of course, after they found out that Franklin and James did it, they tried James, the congressional investigations, charged Franklin and James, and they were tried for murder and conspiracy and treason, right?
Nope.
No, they never were. And that's an interesting question. Now, why would Franklin want to give the atomic bomb to Russia?
Well, you tell me.
I'll tell you exactly why. We were going to get into a space race and a missile race. later on during World War II, I'm going to document this in my speech in Santa Clara, and it's on my three-hour DVD entitled Only the United States Has Nukes. Dwight Eisenhower issued orders to General George Patton at the end of World War II that he was to occupy two cities called Peenemünde and Nordhausen in Germany and turn them intact over to the Russians. The Russians came in and literally torn those factories down to the ashtray on top of the desk and removed the entire structure and all of thousands of V-2 rockets and V-1s as well, transferred them to Russia. They by force took over 2,000 scientists back to to Russia. And a small group of 129 of those scientists, including Wernher von Braun, who was in charge of a German effort, they came to the United States. Later on, a short time later, when Wernher von Braun went to Dwight Eisenhower, who is now president of the United States, and said, we've got the ability to orbit a space satellite. President Eisenhower told him not to do so, and that he was to build a second rocket called the Vanguard. And after he built the Vanguard, he could launch it with that. And so the Vanguard exploded, and of course Russia orbited Sputnik. At least it's been claimed. I now know that they never did. I'll document that in the video. I don't have time to cover it in my speech. But Sputnik never went anywhere. It was a fraud. But that's another issue. Now, Eisenhower gave Russia the whole structure of their future space effort with the V-2 rocket. In fact, in my documentary, I'll show you the evidence that all Russia's done is take 32 V-2 rockets, 50, 60 years later, Scotch tape them around the central core of fuel, and that's the way they launch their heavy space loads. So in 30 to 50 years, that's the best they can do. Isn't that interesting? In other words, they wouldn't have a space effort unless General Eisenhower gave them that space effort in 1945 at the end of the war.
But, of course, so what you have said is that, and I certainly agree with this, that we actually gave them the wherewithal to build the nuclear bombs, certainly George Racy Jordan, Major Jordan, wrote that in his book, and of course it was confirmed by the president's son, James Roosevelt. So we obviously had given them the plans to build a nuclear bomb, but you go right ahead.
But we also gave them the space effort.
Right, so we gave them all these things. So if we gave them all those things, wouldn't they possibly have actually built the bomb?
Nope.
Okay,
go ahead. In 1949, they allegedly exploded as an atomic bomb. It's been the only one that I'm able to find where they exploded. It could very well have been the one that Roosevelt gave them. If it was, it took them 4 to 5 years to put it all together, even though they had the plans. But Harry Truman, I found documentation that Harry Truman did not believe that they exploded an atomic bomb. He was the president in 1949. So I'm not sure they did. Now, from that they claim they've got thousands of warheads and the missiles to launch them with. And I'd like to now bring to your attention, because I am of the contention there's not one warhead in Russia, and there never has been one in Russia. And I want to bring to your attention, Dr. Stan, I have it in front of me, the INF Treaty signed in 1988 by President Ronald Reagan and Premier Mikhail Gorbachev. I have it in my hands, and during the lecture in Santa Clara, I'm going to show you the treaty. And we're going to read it ourselves, word for word, and we're going to see whether or not the Russians have any nuclear weapons to eliminate according to the treaty. The front page of the treaty, dated 1988, says, quote, "Treaty between the United States of America and the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics on the elimination," please remember that word, Dr. Stan, "the elimination of their intermediate range and shorter range missile." That's why it's called the INF, Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces.
Okay, fine. Well, we're going to have to take a little break here. Our guest is Ralph Epperson. He's going to be speaking at the Conspiracy Conference, and Ralph's an old friend. Anyway, we'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Okay, Ralph, go ahead.
Okay, now this treaty was signed by President Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev, and I want to go back and read it again. They're going to eliminate. Notice the word. It's not we're going to analyze or study or discuss. We're going to eliminate the elimination of their intermediate range and shorter range missiles. And now we're going to read how they're going to eliminate. It's in the body of the treaty. And during my lecture, I'll show you the page. We'll read it together. That's all we could do. And I'm going to show you how they are going to eliminate the nuclear weapons. Let's go to page 36 of this treaty. I'm going to have to flip to find it. We're getting close, 35, 36. Here's what it says. Paragraph 3 of Section 2 states that before a missile arrives at the elimination facility, and we're going to just eliminate the missile, its nuclear warhead device and guidance elements may be removed. Nuclear warhead devices and guidance elements are not required to be eliminated because destroying them would be meaningless unless the manufacturer of new such items was also prohibited. Also, since warheads are small, verifying compliance with such a prohibition would be extremely difficult. Now, Dr. Stan, did you see there where they were going to eliminate warheads?
No, they're not going to eliminate warheads. They're going to eliminate the missiles.
No, we'll talk about that next. But at this point, are they going to eliminate the warhead?
Well, if what you have read to me is true, and I don't have any reason to doubt that, why, of course, they're not going to eliminate the warheads. But my understanding is that they have decommissioned many of the warheads now. Is that true or not?
Well, we don't know that, Dr. Stan. Notice there is no verification. We don't go there even watch them remove them. And secondly, we don't stand around and watch them eliminate them. So the treaty says we're going to eliminate warheads, but we don't eliminate warheads. That's on page 36. I got it. We're going to read it. I just read it. Now, you're going to have to trust me until you see it on the screen at my lecture. Okay, now, let's talk about how we're going to eliminate the missiles, page 172. Let's read that next, because I'll show you how we're going to eliminate the missiles. Page 172, paragraph 8. A missile, a stage of such a missile, or a launcher subject to the treaty, shall be subject to inspection only by external visual observation. Now, what does that mean? Can we kick it? No. Can we look inside? No. Can we drop acid on it and see if it's metal? No. Can we cut it open? No. Can we roll it over, do it, touch it in any way? No. Why? I'm going to show you in my DVD, Dr. Stan, articles written, probably a dozen of them, that confirm that Russia builds a variety of fake missiles. I'm going to cite eyewitnesses by the thousands who have seen these all over Russia. So now, and just a few months before, I can't date it from memory right now, but I'll show you the article. Well, about 5 months before this treaty was signed by President Reagan, the Russians admitted that at least 20% of their missiles were fake. Now, if you know that they're going to have some fake missiles, you don't know how many, it might be more than 20%. I met a Jewish immigrant who went to Israel named Abraham Shifrin in 1985. And Mr. Shifrin was a major during World War II. He's now gone on. He's passed away.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment with Ralph Emerson. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Ralph's contention is that the nuclear treaty that we signed with the Russians under Gorbachev basically did not really, if you read what it said that they could take the warhead off the missile before it was deactivated, and you would never actually see the warhead. In other words, we were not allowed to see the warheads. We were just told that they'd been taken off. And then as far as the missiles were concerned, why, we were not allowed to examine the missiles at all or do anything. We could just look at them visually, and once we'd looked at them visually, we were to assume that they were what the Russians said that they were. But you go ahead. Ralph was talking about having met a gentleman named Shifrin. And this gentleman was a Russian refugee, had been in the Russian military. And what did he tell you?
He came to America, on a speaking tour, and I met him in 1985. I drove him for about 80 miles or something from one city to another, to get ready for the speech in my town of Tucson. And so we were talking in the car, and I asked him, Mr. Shiffrin, please understand, this was 1985. I said, I have, for a couple of 3 years, believed that the Russians do not have any warheads and do not have any nuclear missiles. He said, let me tell you that what you say is true. I said, well, how do you know that? He said, I created an institute in Israel when I got there to interview people who came to Israel from Russia about their knowledge of concentration camps. And I show you the book they wrote, something, it's about the 3,000 concentration camps that he documented with over 3 million prisoners, what you want to call them, POWs or inmates. And in that, during the time he was interviewing these people from all over Russia, they reported over and over and over and over again that they had seen phony missiles in their part of Russia. And Mr. Shiffrin told us, later wrote to me, and I'll read the letter, that he himself came to America in 1978 and told the Congressional Investigation Team that he knew personally that there were fake missiles all over Russia. Now, this was known in 78. In 1988, of course, Mr. Shiffrin wrote a book, but it wasn't about the missiles. Now, let's go with this. 10 years later, we're now signing a treaty. The government, by the way, James, all the world's aircraft, I think it's called, the world's leading expert out of London, they are the ones who know more about armaments around the world than any other team or group or nation. And nations use James to determine what the threats are. And I go on Google and Amazon.com, and you can read their publications. And they said over and over again, and I proved this with their own quotes in my DVD, that Russia builds, I forgot the word they used, a plethora almost of fake missiles. They're experts at it. Now, once you know that, and that also appeared just before Reagan signed the treaty, why would you agree to a treaty that says the only inspection you can do is by external visual observation? Please explain that to me, Dr. Stan.
Well, of course, it's really hard to explain, isn't it?
Yes, it is not hard to explain. Let me give you my personal testimony. The INF treaty was signed in 1988 when my senator at the time was Dennis DeConcini. And Dennis was a Democrat from Arizona, and I knew Dennis from about the seventh grade on, all the way through college. We went to the high schools together, we went to college together. I didn't know him well, but just, hi Dennis, how are you? Whenever I'd see him on campus or whenever, we didn't have classes because he was going to pre-law. But about 1985 or 89 or something, about a couple of years after the INF Treaty, when I had the copy of it, I asked Dennis in a public meeting where the public was encouraged to ask a question. I went to the microphone and said, hi, Dennis, you don't remember me, but I'm Ralph Epperson. Ralph Epperson, I remember you, of course, and he was very friendly. I said, Dennis, were you in the Senate when the INF Treaty was approved? Absolutely. I said, did you vote for it? He said, yes. I said, did you read it, Dennis? He said, no. I said, wait a minute, I don't understand, Dennis. Why didn't you read the treaty? He said, well, I trusted Ronald Reagan. I said, wait a minute, Dennis, forgive me. I don't know if you ever noticed, Dennis, you're, quote, a Democrat, unquote, and Reagan was, quote, a Republican, unquote, and the Democrats don't like Republicans, and conversely, Republicans don't like Democrats. Why would you trust a Republican president? Well, I just did. I felt it was important for us to eliminate those missiles. I said, Dennis, can I read to you from the treaty since you didn't read it? And I had it, as I told you, in my hands, and I read in the two parts I just read you. And Dennis said, next questioner, please. I don't know. But I know the Senate ratified this treaty that does not eliminate one warhead and does not even, we don't even know if they eliminate missiles as such. Now, why would any sane president sign such a treaty as that?
Well, of course, you're assuming that we're dealing with sane people. And, of course, our view is that we're dealing with people who have an entirely different worldview and would use deceit and deception. Of course, the whole idea was, and I'm sure it's really true, and I'm sure there were false missiles. The old idea of Sun Tzu had said, you know, to fight and conquer in all of your battles is not supreme excellence. Supreme excellence is to defeat the enemy without fighting, and they were trying to fool us. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Go right ahead, Ralph.
Now, let me ask you this, Dr. Stan. Is it possible that Ronald Reagan and Gorbachev knew there were no warheads to eliminate in Russia?
I don't have no idea, really.
Well, wait a minute. If you believe that they had them and you said the treaty was to eliminate them, why not eliminate them?
Well, remember that Ronald Reagan did not negotiate the treaty.
It
was negotiated by people. He simply signed it.
Huh?
He simply signed it.
Yes, and he urged the Senate to ratify it.
Right.
Now, wait a minute. Maybe Reagan didn't read it either?
Very well he didn't.
Okay, now what kind of man would do that?
Well, unfortunately, sometimes we have leaders who are not as good, who have feet of clay.
Okay, and secondly, Dr. Stan, the Senate ratified it, which means at least, 50 or 60% of the senators approved the treaty as well.
Right. They probably didn't read it either.
They didn't read it either. Now, in other words, we have a phony treaty. The media told us it was going to eliminate. That's what it said. It didn't eliminate one word. Dr. Stan, let me give you another example. I was walking in the Dallas airport, and perhaps as you know, when you walk in there, you walk from one terminal to another, they give you 3 days of food and water, and you start walking. And I was walking down the aisle from one corridor to another, and I heard a little announcement on gate, I'm going to make it up, I don't remember exactly, but it said something like, this is gate 74, and we're now loading flight 703 to Mazatlan, Mexico. And I stopped in the middle of the aisle, I said, oh man, I've always wanted to go to Mazatlan. I think I'm going to trade my ticket for Topeka, because I was going there to speak. I'm going to go to Mazatlan. So I turned around and looked at those lucky people boarding the airplane, and standing in the line was a well-known senator. I'm not going to identify him, but this well-known senator I know had gone to Bilderberg meetings. I've done my research. I know this senator. I don't know him personally, but I know of his background. Now, he was in line. I said, oh, he's got his wife, and they're going to go and enjoy Mazatlan's vacation. No, he's by himself. No, he's got his kids, and he's going to meet his wife. No, there's no kids. He's got his staff, and they're going down there for a meeting and discuss the upcoming year or whatever. No, he's by himself. In fact, this senator was pulling his own carry-on luggage with the wheels and the handle. So I said, no, wait a minute. I'll bet you he's going to a Bilderberg meeting. Now, let's just talk and stop this. The Bilderberg meeting, I don't remember when it first started, Dr. Stan. Maybe you do.
1953.
Okay, 1953. This was probably 1988 or 1990 or something. So it was 20, whatever, 30 years later. He's going to another Bilderberg meeting. I believe they meet once a year, maybe twice a year, but they meet in rather isolated places. Now, the Bilderbergs are the very wealthy, the powerful, the government heads of government.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in a moment with Ralph. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Ralph is simply bringing the reason that he doesn't think that the Russians either have missiles or have nuclear warheads, and he believes that they've bamboozled the American people, or they have bamboozled our government, because our government has been financing Russia since its inception. Maybe this is all aimed at confusing the people of the United States into believing we have a dangerous enemy that can destroy us at any time. Now, Ralph is talking about having, of course, seen a group of people boarding a plane to go to Mazatlan some years ago, and there boarding the plane was an American senator who is a regular attendee at Bilderberger meetings. This is this small group that works within the shadows. It's never mentioned, allowed to be mentioned by the American media. I think there is maybe two articles about it all last year when they had a meeting, but ordinarily that's unusual because you never will see it mentioned in American media. You will see it mentioned in the media throughout the world. You can read about it on the internet, but of course they have such a control over the mass media in the United States that none of those newspapers, with one recent exception, has ever mentioned the Bilderbergers. So anyway, the senator is going to a Bilderberger meeting, and where do we go from there, Ralph?
Okay, now let's just ask this question. One Russian general who learned about the Bilderbergs realized that these were the descendants of the people that killed 40 million Russians during the Russian Revolution. That means that during that revolution, the Russian general learned that these people, the fathers and grandfathers of this group, were the ones that killed 40 million of his patriots, of his fellow Russians during the Russian Revolution when that country went communist. And Americans and Europeans financed the whole revolution, and they built the factories, etc., to make that into an industrial nation. Let's just say that he cited, I'm going to seek justice for $40 million, and he read where this meeting was. He's a general in charge of 15, let's just say, presumably, 15 missiles around Vladivostok. And he reads about this and says, I'm going to nuke them and kill these guys for what they've done and what they're going to do to this nation. Now, notice the Russian general doesn't need an army, doesn't need a revolution, doesn't have to ask permission. He's a general, and if he doesn't know how to reprogram a missile, I don't know who does. So he goes down to the basement the night before, reprograms it, so at 8 o'clock in the morning it's launched, and suddenly the Bilderberg meeting's nuked. Now, let me give you a better example. I've got a picture I show you in the documentary I made of Gorbachev addressing 5,000 communists in the one building at one time, and the picture's taken like from a balcony, so you can see part of the audience sitting in the in its pack in the theater, you know, in the seats in the front, and then up on stage you see Gorbachev at the podium. And behind him were probably 300, I guess maybe the Politburo or executives or wherever it is. And let's take the same question. Let's just presume that this guy says these communists, nobody likes the system except the communists, and even they hate it. And I quote Russians who saw us say that in my documentary. So the Russians that didn't like communism. Now, once again, one Russian general sitting in his Vladivostok, 1,000 miles away, I don't care whatever it is, and he decides to nuke Gorbachev and 5,000 communists and end it. There's never been a revolution against communism, yet the Russian people hate it. Why? Because they have no arms. They've been disarmed. We all know that. Well, they do have a way to resist nuclear weapons. Now, why has there never been a nuke launched on Gorbachev or Khrushchev or any of the others? Why? I wonder why. Maybe because the Russian generals especially, know they don't have any nuclear weapons. And I'm going to show you Russian generals who have said that in my documentary. Russian generals who defected to the West say, we don't have the missiles and the warheads. Russian scientists, I'm going to quote, that I've read their books, and I'll show you the book, you can read it yourself, and they say they don't have the warheads and the missiles. Now, in other words, there's never been a nuke dropped in anger in Russia, even though the people and the generals hate the system. Why? Why? Maybe because Gorbachev and Reagan and all these generals know they don't have any warheads. Notice the Russians have never used a warhead anywhere. Remember when they took over the Eastern European countries? They moved into Poland and Czechoslovakia and Hungary. I remember those in the 50s and 60s. Not one nuke was dropped. Why? When they finally signed some other treaties, they allegedly removed other missiles and warheads, but none of those missiles and warheads were in these foreign countries. Thirdly, there were no Russian missiles and no Russian warheads in Cuba during the entire Cuban Missile Crisis, and I proved that with the documents to show you. It's another fraud. We look at the evidence. The pictures of the ships leaving with these missiles on board, no, not one picture of a missile. I show you the U.S. News report has an overhead picture taken apparently from an airplane, maybe like 100 feet above, down on the deck, and the caption reads, Soviets remove warheads from Cuba to end the Cuban Missile Crisis. And I ask the question, all you can see is tarps covering wooden frames, and that's it. How can a camera tell in 1962 or 3 what's underneath the tarp?
You're talking about a tarpaulin. Yes, I remember thinking at that time, are there really missiles on those Russian ships, or was this simply a charade? And, of course, I've always felt it was a charade. I think the whole Cuban Missile Crisis was a charade. The Bay of Pigs invasion was a charade. Cuba over to Fidel Castro, a known communist by our State Department, CIA, was all a part of a charade, which they cannot let the American people understand. But, of course, that's covered in my talk on the World Revolution, available from Radio Liberty. But you go right ahead, Ralph.
Dr. Stead, I quote Oleg Penkovsky, who was the highest-ranking general who defected to America. It was in the Intelligence Department. And I read his book entitled Penkovsky Papers. And in there he says, the reason we didn't put missiles and warheads in Cuba is because we didn't have any. Now, wait a minute. We believe Khrushchev, but not Penkovsky. And there's not one physical shred of evidence there were warheads and or missiles, including the testimony of John Kennedy himself. We read the documentation. The whole thing was a scam. There were, I'll be honest with you, I remember, Dr. Stanton, I was a young man living in Los Angeles, and when they were going to board the ships to inspect, as Kennedy demanded and told Khrushchev in two separate communications, we will board to confirm those missiles are being withdrawn. And no one ever boarded anything. And I was shaking because the boarding of a foreign ship in the open waters, in the illegal, you know, the, what do they call it, off, the offshore or whatever it is, when you're in international waters, boarding of another nation's ships could be construed as an act of war. And I remember standing there thinking, my God, we're going to a nuclear war because we're going to board those ships. And no one boarded anything. So we've got pictures of tarps covering wooden examples, and I show you three of those pictures and the captions underneath, claiming by U.S. News and others they're removing missiles. There were no missiles in Cuba, and John Kennedy said that himself personally.
Where did he say that personally?
He said that in the book written by Bobby Kennedy entitled 13 Days. Bobby Kennedy was a participant because he was the Attorney General. In 1962, he dates it in October or something like, I've forgotten the date, but he reports that they showed up and there were 18 people in the room, and the CIA brought these pictures of the U-2 airplanes, and they looked at them, and Bobby Kennedy something paraphrased, I quote the exact word and tell you what page it's on. He said, we looked at the pictures, and I, for one, didn't see any missiles. I was relieved later on to find out that no one else saw any missiles, including President Kennedy.
All right, in other words, basically what they did was they supposedly had this site with a lot of dirt moved around, and supposedly this is where they're going to put the missiles, but there just weren't any there.
Bobby showed, I've forgotten, four or five pictures of these pictures released by the CIA in his book, and I show you one of them. And what they did, they took low level, or at least, I'm sorry, maybe they were a telephoto lens, because you can't fly, even the U-2, I'm sure, is flying at 80 or 100,000 feet, whatever it was. They're taking pictures on the ground. And the CIA came in with little white labels saying, this is what this is, and they identified it, and none of the pictures show missiles. And later on, a few years later, the man who inspected this and analyzed it, Dino Brugioni or something like that, I show you that picture because it was released in my local newspaper, and it shows him inside a Quonset hut, and he said, this is where we believe they hid the missiles. It was alleged that they hid the missiles in these tent-like structures, and alleged. He kept saying the word alleged.
But, of course, the thing that we were told is that the Khrushchev was bringing the missiles in to put there in this base, and that was, it wasn't that the missiles were already there. He was going to bring them in, and you're absolutely right. All we saw were the pictures, you know, of these big round items covered over by a tarp, and we were told those are the missiles. Of course, the question is, what was under the tarp? We will never know. Go ahead.
And that's correct. And I quote a Russian intelligence officer, Oleg Penkovsky. I show you the book. I show you the page to make sure you understand I'm documenting this. He said, we didn't put any missiles and warheads in Cuba because we didn't have any. Now, why should we believe Khrushchev and not him? That's the question you'll have to ask the administration of John Kennedy.
Well, I think we ought to ask why the American media would do everything they could to convince the American people that the Russians did have the missiles, but go ahead.
Now, there, please understand, Dr. Stan, I know what I'm saying, and I know it's contrary to I don't know of anyone else. I've been saying this since 1985, especially after Abraham Shiffrin confirmed it in part when he said that there are thousands of Russians, former Russians in Israel who've certified that they've seen these fake missiles all over, and I quote other experts. I show you the articles. I want to make this clear, Dr. Stan. I don't have a time. I've got an hour with you or so, whatever, and we're both talking, we're taking commercials, etc., so maybe we got 45 minutes. I've got a three-hour DVD that people can buy for $10. I'm not trying to make any money on this, cover my expenses. I charge $2 for it. If you want to go watch it yourself, and all I ask is you be open. If you watch it and then decide that I'm wrong, fine. It's like going on jury. After I'm through, you're convinced I'm guilty, even though I'm pleading innocent. If you watch it openly, you will be convinced that I'm right.
Why don't you tell our listeners how they can get in touch with your ministry?
Dr. Stan, thank you very much. I have an 800 number. If anyone wants to contribute or comment or criticize, 800-422-3888. Notice I'm so stupid.
One more time.
Pay for the call.
All right. Repeat the number again, Rob.
800-422-3888. You can go to my website, ralph-epperson.com. Ralph, R-A-L-P-H, dash Epperson with two P's, E-P-P is in Peter, E-R-S-O-N.com. Go there and read about it. Now, I put my first video on DVD on, it was called No Nukes But U.S. Nukes, and I've updated it because I found five more pieces of evidence in the last year that further confirmed that I'm right, and I had to update it. And so I did that, and I can now call it Only the U.S. Has Nukes. I decided that No Nukes But U.S. Nukes sounds like I'm trying to advocate a world treaty to eliminate nuclear weapons, but keep, you know, let us keep ours. And that's not what I'm doing. I'm showing you that this is that everything that I'm saying I know is contrary to what we've been taught. But the first guy out of the chute, as you know, Dr. Stan, they laughed at Orville and Wilbur Wright and the telephone man, Edison, everybody else, said, you'll never make it work. I'm telling you, please be open and watch this because this is vital. It's costing us trillions of dollars. I will also quote Lyndon Johnson, who said during his administration that we are harboring fears we didn't need to harbor about the nuclear war threat.
And where did he say that?
All I can tell you, Dutch Stan, is the book is in, I show you the book. I've not read it. I'm taking a quote out of it. I have to admit I'm doing that. But I went to the Amazon.com and found the book, and I found out who the author was, and the book is for sale. It's out of print, $65, and I don't have that kind of money to buy it.
Now, what was the title of the book?
Dr. Stan, I'll be honest with you, I have to go to my, I don't have it committed to memory.
All right, and that's all right. You can't remember everything. You're doing a pretty good job, Ralph. Go ahead.
It is cited in my documentary, and I will say this. Jeffrey Rickelson, R-I-C-H-E-L-S-O-N, who wrote the book. It's about the fact that now that we have, I guess it was in the 80s or 60s sometime, they point out that the space satellites now are confirmed. We now are able to count missiles on the ground rather than take estimates from various sources of intelligence. So we're now able to see it, and Lyndon went on to point out, we have been building things we didn't need to build. We've been doing things we didn't need to build. And he points out, we have been harboring fears we didn't need to harbor. Now, think about that, Dr. Stan. And the thing that I appreciate so much about Lyndon Johnson is once he figured this out, that this was costing us trillions of dollars for a fake, Lyndon Johnson, I remember this, I'm sure, Dr. Stan, you were about the same age as I am, and you remember Lyndon Johnson going on national television to tell us he's discovered the fact that Russia doesn't have all these warheads and missiles, and he's going to stop it, stop building all these programs. You remember that, Dr. Stan?
No, I don't.
Yeah, strangely enough, neither do I. But I point out, why didn't he tell us the truth? And that answers the question, what is this whole thing all about? It's called spending. This has cost us trillions of dollars. And the more that the Russians built up technology, the more we believe them. In the DVD, not in this speech, I don't have time. In the DVD, I show you the evidence that Yuri Gagarin, the first man in space, never orbited anything. I show you the evidence that the Sputnik never orbited anything. I show you the evidence that Alexei Leonov, the first man in space, never orbited anything. In fact, Dr. Stan, an author by the name of Lloyd Nallen, I show you the book. I bought it and read it, and he went, according to his book, he went to Russia, and during that time he was there, he got copies of their evidence that Leonov walked in space, brought them back to the United States, and they confirmed that he was shot. His pictures that they released were shot in a tank of water.
And, of course, I've always wondered why the Russians were able to land their missiles on hard land, whereas we always had to land ours in the ocean to absorb the shock of landing. How come the Russians were so much better at that than we were?
Yes.
That was one thing that always bothered me, and, of course, the other thing was that with the advanced Russian technology, it was Nixon that sent American scientists over to Russia to help them prepare to go to the space shuttle, in other words, the space station. In other words, we were going to build a space station, and we had to help the Russians build up the technology so that they could put a man into space. Why did we have to do that if they were so far advanced? And that is a question that's always puzzled me. Go right ahead.
Dr. Stan, we sold the Russians the copies, the plans for our space shuttle. Like, I think it was $200,000 or $500. Now, was that a bargain to the Russians? And they actually built one. They orbited it. They got it off the ground once, and then they stopped the program. And according to the newspapers, an Australian bought it and took it to Australia as a sideshow. They don't have any space shuttle.
However, we're going to be back here in just a moment with Ralph Everson to wrap up the program. Well, Ralph, go right ahead. You got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Thank you very much. Please understand, Dr. Stan, I know what I'm saying, and I know that people are thinking this is actually impossible. I can only tell you this. So far, everyone that I know that has watched the video, friends of mine, have come back and said, my God, Ralph, I think you got something. Now, they were open. Now, I have to admit, they watched it because of me. And I told them, please, if you don't agree with me, tell me point blank. But they don't do that. I'm telling you, Dr. Stan, it's 3 hours long. I know that's a long DVD, but watch it openly on your own and then decide from the evidence. I keep showing you pictures and books. And, by the way, let's talk about this. The Scud missile. You all heard about the Scud missile. The Scud missile, 60 years later, is nothing more than the V-2 rocket with a new covering. And I prove it. I prove it. The Kuwaitis, the Iraqis fired 7 of these Scud missiles into Kuwait, and they injured 7 people. Boy, that's an efficient weapon, isn't it? It didn't kill anybody, but they injured people. Now, let me ask you this, Dr. Stan. Even the newspapers reported that the Scud was very inefficient, not capable of doing any damage. I believe the V-2 rocket did not have the ability to be moved in as it was going. It's like a bullet. You point it at it and you fire it, and that's where it goes. It had no guidance equipment, and that's exactly what the Scud does. So it's nothing more than in 60 years the Russians have got nothing, no better technology than to take the V-2 rocket that they know works because the Germans proved it worked. They take the cover off, put a new one on it, and then call it the Scud. And Arabian nations are buying the Scud today, and they're the ones that are parading around in these parades, and the Scud isn't worth diddly squat. And that's the best they can do. I'm going to show you pictures in my DVD of them taking 24, as I already pointed out, a 32 of the V-2 rocket, and scotch taping them together around the central core. Now, trying to get 32 rockets to fire together in precision is very difficult. And you know what? I cite Russian scientists who have written books on that subject. They call it the bunch system, and it doesn't work. Dr. Stan, this is the biggest scam that I've found so far in all my research for 40-some years.
All right, well, we're just about out of time, and I do appreciate it, Ralph, and I'll have to admit that I will try to watch that DVD. Would you be showing that at the conspiracy conference?
No, but I'm taking copies of it. I'm going to give my lecture with half the slides, an hour and a half.
All right, fine. Well, I'm sure it'll be an excellent presentation. I appreciate everything you've done, and I'll tell you what, it's very, very provocative, and you ask a lot of difficult questions.
God
bless
you. Thank you very much, Dr. Stan.
Thanks so much. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and that was Ralph Everson. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Ralph Everson. Ralph is a very sincere individual, and I'll tell you what, he does ask some very provocative questions. And, of course, what we always say is there's a great deal of difference between perception, in other words, what we believe, and reality, which is what is the truth is. And, of course, our reality is constantly being controlled by the people who control the mass media, and they mold our ideas and our questions and our tastes, and they create our reality for us through the medium of radio and television and newspapers. Is it possible Ralph is right? Yes, anything is entirely possible. What do we really know? Well, we know what we've read in the newspapers, what we've watched on television, what we've heard on the radio. And I would like to suggest to you, ladies and gentlemen, that maybe we ought to stop and ask some of the provocative questions. And I think the biggest one is certainly, do the Russians really have nuclear weapons? Why would we be doing everything we could to build up the Soviet Union? Why would we be doing everything we could to build up communist China and, of course, to help them develop their nuclear weapons and certainly their missile guidance systems? Why would we be doing that if they threaten to attack us someday? Well, the only reason I could expect that is because our leaders want a nuclear war someday, and, of course, that nuclear war will be aimed at our cities and our people. Why would rational people want that? Because we're not dealing with rational people. We're dealing with people who have a different worldview and a different objective. We're dealing with people who are actively working for the dark side and want to bring the issues that are discussed in Revelation 6-8 to reality. The destruction of a quarter of the population of the world through the sword, through pestilence, which is disease, and certainly through famine. Could those things be happening? And what part will nuclear weapons play in it? Well, we're just going to have to wait and see. I hold my reservations on what Ralph says. On the other hand, I respect him. He has put a great deal of time and effort into this. Well, to really understand the spiritual component of what we're up against, let me suggest that you get my book or watch the DVD on the Brotherhood of Darkness, that you watch the DVD on the forbidden secret, because there is a secret that's been passed down for 5,000 years. It's certainly been talked a great deal about by Rhonda Burns on Oprah Winfrey's show and Larry King's show, and of course, 7 million copies of the book, The Secret, and 4 or 5 million copies of the DVD, The Secret. I've been marketed in the United States and throughout the world, and millions of Christians have accepted this lie. And let me tell you that what Rhonda Byrne says is there's a genie out there, and you can get that genie to do whatever you want to. If you use the law of attraction, why, you have the ability to change the world. In fact, you do that because you are God. Now, what a ridiculous thing. That's exactly what the serpent said in the Garden of Eden to Eve. You know, you could be as God, and ye shall never die. And what we are seeing played out today is really an enactment of the ancient prophecies, and so we do hope many of you will want to get our material on the forbidden secret and the syllabus that comes with that, which will help you better to understand President Bush's first and second State of the Union messages. You need to understand that to understand what he's talking about when he talks about the angel who rides in the whirlwind and directs his storm. Do you remember that statement in the first State of the Union message? When he was inaugural speech, I guess the two inaugural speeches. Who is the angel who rides in the whirlwind and directs his storm? Well, certainly we tell you in our talk, The Forbidden Secret. And then, of course, our talk on the planned police state. We hope that you want to get some of the other items we talk about, the DVDs on the secret mysteries of America's beginnings, the DVD on Riddles in Stone. The DVDs, the 3-hour, the 4-hour, the 10-hour version of They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, RadioLiberty.com. Please pray for Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, for the next hour, they're going to be those of Howard Nemiroff, and we're going to be talking about his book, which is entitled 400 Years of Gun Control, Why It Isn't Working. Well, with that as a background, Howard, thank you very much for being with us this evening.
Well, thank you for having me on your show, Dr. Monteith.
And, of course, we've had Howard before, but this is a fascinating book. Of course, this is the first time I've actually seen the book. I read the manuscript before, but let's get into the background of the book. How did it happen that you wrote the book? Because my understanding is that until fairly recently, you were in favor of gun control.
That's true. In fact, until recently, I thought that civilian disarmament was a good idea. It seemed reasonable. I believed, like I think a lot of people do, who don't look beneath the illusion, that I believe that guns are dangerous and they kill people, and if nobody owned guns, there would be less killing going on. And then one of my clients, I'm a healthcare practitioner, one of my clients who works as a law enforcement professional and also was a Green Beret in the military, was talking to me about self-defense and the right of self-defense, and he threw some ideas at me that I just couldn't easily rebut. So I thought, well, I better look a little deeper, and I did dig to see what was behind the facade of gun control.
And, of course, you've done a tremendous job, Howard. I really am very, very impressed with the material that you have there, and I think that this certainly is one of the definitive books on should we, of course, support gun control, or should we support the Second Amendment? Should we certainly recognize the fact that there are those people who would like to establish a dictatorship in America? They're called neoconservatives. People think that neoconservatives are conservative. They're not. They're Trotskyites. They control the executive branch of government today. Like termites, they've infiltrated every aspect of our society. And, of course, they're disciples of Machiavelli. And you read Machiavelli, and what is Machiavelli advocating? A tyrannical state. They are disciples of Plato. Now, what does Plato advocate? A philosopher king to rule the common people because they can't rule themselves. And there really are people of this framework of thought working at the highest levels of our government in Washington, D.C. today. So with that as a background, you go ahead and pick up the story of what was it that convinced you that gun control would not solve our problems?
Well, again, just swimming along the surface of this subject, and of course, in that sense, I agreed with the thesis that's promoted by Brady Campaign and Violence Policy Center and other gun ban organizations, and that's that where guns, you know, the guns are used to commit violence, and guns create a situation of greater violence, and that we should get rid of them. So I initially looked at some of the places that did exactly that, and early in my research I found two countries that are fairly similar to ours, one being the United Kingdom and one being Australia. These are two countries that, you know, by and large speak English. They have some sort of bicameral legislature, and you know, representatives are elected democratically.
Well, that's all. We'll be back in just a moment.
So they should. Okay.
Howard.
Can we have to take a break? Oh, no.
Right now, go right ahead.
Okay. And So they were fairly similar to us as Western civilizations, Western political, socio-political structures. And I started doing research at the behest of my law enforcement client into those two countries and found that, well, gee, these are two countries that in the mid to late 1990s banned firearms pretty much. Australia, you can still own certain firearms, though handguns have to be 17 caliber, which is fairly small. It's almost an air gun. And in Britain, of course, it's virtually impossible to own a firearm. So after these gun bans were enacted, lo and behold, the violent crime rates went up quite a bit in both of these countries. Whereas the United States, where the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms notes that about 4 to 5 million firearms were sold to the civilian population every year through the 1990s, violent crime was dropping. So suddenly I'm hit with this reality that there doesn't appear to be any correlation between the number of guns that are owned and the violent crime rate.
Well, let me ask you a question. One of the things you point out is that the anti-gun people claim that you're 43 more times more likely that a friend, a family member, or an acquaintance will be killed, in a home where there's a firearm. How do you answer that charge?
Yeah, I've seen that claim in varying ways, and now, of course, I see it in the editorials that people write and say, well, you know, people are more likely to be shot by their own gun, or the criminals can take your gun away and use it against you. Now, a few years ago, the National Academy of Sciences organized a research committee to look into this and other gun control research, and they really went through the whole breadth of everything from all the anti-gun research to John Watt's research that he put into More Guns, Less Crime. So it really covered a whole spectrum. What this research group found was that claim that the gun in the home is 43 times more likely to kill a family member than a criminal was, it's a complicated story. First of all, they found that the conclusion...
Hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment. We'll be right back in just... Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Howard was talking about the National Science, NSA, apparently a scientific organization, that had analyzed, of course, the arguments for and against gun control. And they apparently somebody had come up with a figure that if there was a gun in the house, why it was 43 more times more likely than that somebody would be shot or killed or, you know, because there was a gun in the house, therefore guns are killing people, therefore we should take guns out of the home. So pick up with that story. What did the National Science Academy really find?
The National Academy of Science found that they agreed with the very, very small data set that Dr. Kellerman came up with. However, they said the conclusions that Kellerman came up with do not follow. Here's a quote, certainly effective defense of gun use need not ever lead the perpetrator to be wounded or killed. Rather, to assess the benefits of self-defense, one needs to measure crime and injury averted. The particular outcome of an offender is of little relevance. In other words, they're saying that there could be an untold number of defensive gun uses that did not result in the home invader being shot. And Dr. Kellerman ignored this fact. The other thing that I find is curious is that Kellerman's data set was essentially one county in Washington State. Okay, so that's a few hundred thousand people at most. And comparing that, for instance, in 2005 radio interview, Peter Hamm, who's the communications director for the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence, was asked to consider that firearm-related death for minors in Texas, which was obviously a pro-gun state, was far less than California's, which is the country's leader in gun control laws. But Peter Hamm called this a, quote, statistical aberration, unquote. So my point is that they're very elastic in what they think is statistically valid as opposed to what is a statistical aberration. Kellerman's data set is a few hundred thousand in one county. The other data set comparing Texas to California, those are the two most populous states in the countries, and since that doesn't the data doesn't show what the Brady campaign wants, they pass it off as a statistical aberration. So there's a lot of problems with this 43 times as likely, or whatever variation is popular today. It's done by cherry-picking, finding a very, very small data set that will, quote, prove, unquote, what they want to prove. Now, there's two problems with that. One is comparing that small data set to the entire national data set of the entire U.S., you get a problem called sampling error. In other words, the experience of a small group of people doesn't translate very well to an extremely large group of people. Kind of losing my train of thought here. Two is that they are trying to come up with a conclusion at the beginning of their research paper. Now, I've seen this a lot in the anti-gun research. When I was in college, when you did research, you asked an open-ended question. You said, well, I don't know if guns in the home assist the defender or do they make it more dangerous to the family? That would be a more valid question, but to come right out and say, well, I believe that guns in the home are dangerous, and now I'm going to go out and find a data set to prove it. That's not research. That is editorializing and manipulating data to come to a predetermined conclusion. And, of course, when people do that, you have to doubt their motives. What is their bias, and why are they trying to force us to believe something? What's in it for them, and what's in it for the people that are in office that are citing this kind of research in order to promote gun control?
Well, I think it's very important that people read your book, because you've been going back to the history of gun control in the United States. And, of course, the title of the book, 400 Years of Gun Control, does it really work? Well, you start out with the Indians, and, of course, the fact that, well, I'm going to let you tell the story about the Indians, about the blacks, how, of course, gun control is always used to control the population, a population that you fear, and the people in Washington, D.C., and in Sacramento, in California, who want to take the guns away from the people, want to control the people, if that's the truth of the matter, but they're not going to tell you that. It's all about control. So why don't you start at the very beginning of your book, Howard, because you do an excellent job there.
Okay. Well, yeah, the beginning of the book, I did look at 400 years of gun control. My concern was that, well, actually, gun control does work. It just depends on what side of the muzzle that you're standing. When our forebears started settling this country, they already understood the concept of gun control as a form of control. And the early settlers, the early colonists, were clearly outnumbered by the Native American population. So in order to control the situation, they needed to find some technological advantage. A small group that has a clear technological advantage over a much larger group can often win, whereas strength of numbers alone would go in favor of the larger group. Well, the Europeans brought firearms. And, of course, at first some enterprising traders, businessmen, decided, well, you know, we could make money selling firearms to the Native Americans, to the Indians, and, you know, we could get rich quick. So they did, and, of course, that started tilting the balance of power, and the colonists didn't like that. So the early colonies started passing laws saying that, well, you can't sell guns to the Indians. And, of course, smuggling is probably as old as certain other illegal behaviors that have been institutionalized. So people figured out ways to around those laws. Well, then the colonists had to pass more laws. So first they started with, and I know you living in California will relate to this, the colonists came up with an ammunition ban, which is what they're doing in Sacramento right now. And, of course, that didn't work completely, so then they made it a crime for any gunsmith to repair guns that were owned by Indians, and they couldn't provide any pieces of guns or any pieces of, you know, elements that went towards making ammunition, powder, for example. So it goes on and on that way. Law after law, when law didn't work, they passed another law. Well, of course, the Europeans had one advantage, and that was that they figured out how to set up the Indians as pawns in their own territorial wars, so they had one tribe fight off another tribe, and the attrition helped, and then, of course, the diseases like smallpox that were imported from Europe also helped, and the rest, of course, is history. They did win that battle. Moving on to the 17 and 1800s, they used the same formula to control free blacks. Before the Civil War, they began to write laws that banned blacks from owning even knives of any size, as well as firearms.
And of course, even going that, to the point that, that even applied to the free blacks. In other words, the blacks were no longer slaves.
Well, after the Civil War, yes. Then there was the Black Codes. Before the Civil War, state legislatures and constitutions started changing wording so that blacks were not even citizens. That's the way they got around it. So free blacks were not citizens, therefore not only could they not vote, they couldn't do things like own firearms. After the Civil War, yes, there were. Then they started instituting more Black Codes that would ban blacks from owning firearms. Because history also shows that when people are armed, people can become free. And the Black Codes were aimed at essentially keeping the blacks as slaves. And this persisted for quite a while after the Civil War.
And, of course, the same thing holds true in Hitler's Germany. Hitler disarmed the Jews before he killed them, certainly in Armenia. Why, the Turks disarmed the Armenians before they killed them. Russia, of course, they disarmed the people. In Rwanda, they disarmed the people before they slaughtered 800,000 Christians. They did the same thing in communist China. They do this in every totalitarian state to disarm the people so they can control them. And then, of course, the greatest, of course, murders of all time are the governments. And between the people that they killed in Armenia and in Rwanda and Russia and communist China, because the people were disarmed and had no means to protect themselves. I mean, we worry, and certainly it's a tragedy when anybody's shot with a weapon here in the United States. But if you look at these other countries, you're talking about literally almost 200 million people over the last century, between 150 million and 200 million people were slaughtered by their own government because they were disarmed. Would you rather have a few people killed by gun accidents, or would you rather have mass extermination of the population?
Well, yeah, that's true. In about 7-8 years, Adolf Hitler killed as many people in that period of time. It was so many that it would take over 10,000 years at our current homicide rate. It would take over 10,000 years for America's criminals to arrive at the same number of deaths. And Hitler did it in just, you know, half a dozen years, a handful of years. And that's just one example. And he wasn't the worst. Stalin was worse than him, and Mao Zedong was worse than Stalin.
Amen to that. We'll be back in here in just a moment with Howard Nimroff talking about his book, 400 Years of Gun Control. Why isn't it working? Howard, you go right ahead.
Well, yeah. The other point is that even you mentioned, well, would it be better to obviously it's better to live in a country like ours. But the other thing people need to know is that there is no correlation between the ability of the civilians to own firearms and the murder rate. For example, a lot of people are surprised when they find out that Russia is has the highest number of murders every year, not the United States. And the same with suicide. Sometimes this is another gun control gambit, is that, well, you know, more guns, more suicide. The only correlation is the more guns, the more gun-assisted suicides. However, again, countries like Russia, Japan, countries where it's virtually impossible for a civilian to own firearms, have much higher suicide rates than we do in the United States. Since the United Kingdom and Australia banned firearms, their overall suicide rate's gone up. Some of these gun banners with their tunnel vision say, oh, but there's less suicides where people are shooting themselves. And I think that that's disrespectful to these people who are obviously suffering emotionally and psychologically, because the fact is no matter how they kill themselves, they've killed themselves. And that's a sad fact, and that's what we need to look at. We need to look at what makes people kill other people, what makes them kill themselves. Those are far more important than whether a gun was available or not. There's no correlation there.
Well, of course,
I have data set after data set that confirms that.
Well, of course, you point out that there's certainly a much lower rate of violence in the United States over this period of the gun bans in Australia and Great Britain than there were in those countries. Why don't you go into those statistics? Because those really are so significant. Certainly, if banning guns would really help, why, of course, it should have done away with murder and homicide and crimes of violence in Australia and Great Britain. Has it?
No. Yeah. If only. One of the things that I came across, which really, really disturbed me, was what happened to sexual assaults and rapes in Australia and the United Kingdom. Okay, remember the United Kingdom and Australia banned guns, so other gun ban proponents say that, well, you know, guns and violence, you know, where there's guns, there's more violence against women. Okay. Well, since the United Kingdom banned firearms, their rate of rape has gone up 76.5%. In Australia, since they banned firearms, their rate of rape has increased 21.4%. But in the United States, in the same time period, it's decreased 16.8%. In Britain now, women are raped twice as often as women in the United States. And in Australia, women are now raped nearly three times as often as women in the United States. That doesn't sound like a success to me. And that's not the only thing. The rates of assault, robbery, have gone up in both countries, where they have dropped here. The murder rates, kind of about the same, but it's one thing about those two cultures, they never really had a lot of murder. So there's some other cultural...
Hold that thought. Welcome to Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Howard Nemiroff. We're talking about his book, 400 Years of Gun Control. He's simply saying that if you look at, for instance, crimes against women in Great Britain and Australia, after the gun control went in, why the incidence of violence against women dramatically increased in both countries, and the statistics are all in his book. And that, of course, but the incidence of crimes against women had actually fallen here in the United States significantly, about 16% during this same time period. And as far as the acts of violence, of course, overall violence, certainly much less in America, declining in America while increasing in these countries with gun control. Now, what about certainly gun-related crimes? Do we have any statistics on that in these countries that have banned guns?
Well, I mentioned it in my book. I've seen a number of reports from reliable sources in Britain, like the British Broadcasting Service and the London Times. They consistently report that what they call gun crime has gone up. It's about doubled since the gun ban was enacted. That, again, hardly seems like a raging success. You would think that if any country could successfully pull off a gun ban, it would be a fairly small island country like the United Kingdom. But they can't even secure their borders and keep the smugglers out. And gun crime has doubled. So, again, another data point saying that it failed.
Of course, that's that old adage that when guns are outlawed, only the outlaws will have guns. The criminal has nothing to fear because he knows that the people are defenseless because the government has taken away their right to keep and bear arms. It's just like sitting in the United States. It is a federal crime now to have a gun on a school campus. So that makes every one of our school and university campuses a target range for murderers. And this is why there's so many crimes, of gun crimes in our schools. Why? Because the criminal knows, wants to go in and slaughter a lot of people, that there will be nobody to oppose him. It should be so obvious, it should be so self-evident, but of course our politicians can't seem to see that.
Well, you're absolutely right. In fact, for instance, in the last 9 months or so, I've been observing where the mass shootings occur. Except for one, they've happened in places where law-abiding civilians are banned from owning firearms, either a shopping mall, which mistakenly thinks that, well, if we ban firearms, it'll be safer, or colleges, schools, where the right to keep and bear arms has been suspended. So these are actually Second Amendment-free zones. So then, the gun banners turn around and say, see, if we banned guns, this wouldn't have happened. But the fact is they've already banned guns. And, of course, right now we have the D.C. Gun ban case before the Supreme Court, and there's another situation where Washington, D.C. has passed a law that makes it impossible for anybody living in Washington, D.C. to have a functioning firearm.
Any law-abiding citizens, the criminals, of course, can use it because criminals aren't going to obey the laws, but law-abiding citizens are not allowed to have a weapon to defend themselves.
That's correct. And since they instituted that gun ban, their violent crime rate and their murder rate have skyrocketed. Their murder rate hangs around 5 to 6 times the national average, and their violent crime rate is about 3 to 4 times the national average. Again, that doesn't sound exactly like a raging success, and as you said earlier, the criminals now are guaranteed of the fact that the civilians, the law-abiding civilians, can't fight back. Now, recently I tracked the story about the restaurant invasions in Oakland.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Fortunately, some of the restaurant owners started fighting back, and shortly after that, these guys, I guess their whole scene fell apart, and maybe they got busted. But while it was happening, I was thinking, I know why it's happening in California, and I know why this kind of thing doesn't happen in Texas. Because in California, if you're a law-abiding citizen going out to eat at a restaurant, you were banned from carrying a gun. Whereas in Texas, a group of punks who were contemplating robbing restaurants know that there's a very good chance that there will be a few people in there who are legally carrying concealed, and that raises the potential cost of doing that particular robbery. So they don't do it.
And I think you have to understand this, the psychology of the criminal. He doesn't want to end up getting shot. He doesn't mind if somebody else gets shot. He doesn't want to get shot. He's not going to go someplace where he knows people may be armed, and he pulls a gun and threatens people or shoots someone. He may get shot in return. We'll be back in just a moment with Howard Nemeroff on 400 Years of Gun Control. Well, Dr. Stan, back here. Go ahead. Howard picked the story up from there.
Well, that was... that point was pretty well made. I did want to share one other little interesting thing that I found out about Australia, though. You know, firearms dealers were supposed to be involved in the multi-hundred million dollar national guns buyback scheme. And then when they got these guns in their possession, they were supposed to destroy them. However, a recent newspaper report has found that thousands of these firearms that were confiscated and supposedly destroyed were instead diverted to the black market and sold. So even under a government program, and I cover this more when I discuss the United Nations in Chapter 6, even a government program is no guarantee that the guns will disappear. Sometimes the government program is responsible for getting guns into the hands of the criminal. And this is a very important point, because one of the arguments that the gun banners say is that, well, you know, if we're going to deal with the illegal gun issue, we have to deal with the legal gun issue, because most criminals get their guns from law-abiding citizens, you know, through robberies and things like that. So, you know, we have to control the guns, because otherwise they'll end up in criminal hands. But here we have proof that, well, actually, if you really want to get guns into the hands of criminals, you should be in a government program, because you get a lot more guns to the criminals than through normal means of burglary of a law-abiding citizen's house.
I mean, there's so many incredible aspects to this, and the thing is that, you know, somebody once said, you know, well, one of the legislators said, well, I'll tell you what, I'll vote for your gun control bill, but first of all, you've got to stipulate that the criminals will turn in their guns, and then 60 days after all the criminals have turned in their guns, then we'll vote and we'll have the law-abiding citizen turn in their guns. And the man proposing the legislation said, well, that's absurd. The criminals are not going to turn in their guns. And the fellow said, that's right. That's why your legislation is absurd, because the criminals are not going to abide by the law. And the only person who's going to be deprived of the right to keep and bear weapons is the law-abiding citizen who needs those weapons to protect himself against the criminal element. And I really fear that as we move into a period of chaos and crisis here in the United States, more and more Americans are going to need those weapons to protect themselves, because the police are simply not going to be able to control all of the chaos that is going to come about in our society. We're going to be back in just a moment with Howard Nimeroff. Well, this is Dr. Stan here. Our guest is Howard Nimeroff. His book is 400 Years of Gun Control. And certainly our telephone number, if you'd like to call us, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 464-8295. But before we go on, why, of course, Howard, how can people get to your website? How can people get copies of your book?
Well, the first commercial run is, I think, going into production now, so we're going to go live within the next 2 weeks. There's a couple of places we'll be selling them through online sellers like Barnes & Noble. Your local bookseller will be able to order them from the publisher. And more information about that is at Contrast Media Press. So that's www.contrastmediapress.com. You will find a picture of my book, and that's a live link, and you'll click to another page. And when those links go live, which should be fairly soon, you'll be able to click through and order a book.
Did you have a telephone number for people to call to order the book?
Well, they could call the number at Contrast Media Press, which is on the website, and they could call me. I will be able to sell them a book too if they
want to. Well, why don't you
get
the number out there so people can know? Because I'll tell you just from long experience, people really want to much easier to call, telephone call than to go up on the web and get the number. So what's the number to call?
Well, let me see if I can bring it up real fast. My number is 512-658-2318.
Let's repeat that again. You always have to repeat the number.
512-658-2318.
All right.
And let me see if I can get Contrast Media Press up here real quick. Okay, here it is. Get there, the website.
It's 562-295-0652. That's 562-925-0652 for Contrast Media Press.
You're quicker than I am.
Well, no, I'm not quicker than you are. I just happen to have your book here with the card on the inside of it. Anyway, if you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question for Howard, I think this is an important issue. Now, there was a researcher, and I think he was back in the American Enterprise Institute, as I remember, John Lott, and he did a research subject on guns, you know. Did gun control really limit crime? And he wrote a book called More Guns, Less Crime. More guns, less crime. Of course, the other side hates that idea because it puts a lie to everything they're trying to do. What they're not being honest with you is that many of these people really want to control. They're not interested in the children, although they talk about the children. They're not interested in the women, although they talk about the women. It's all about control. And when you understand that, of course, this is much easier to understand. But, of course, we've got to be able to discuss this thing intelligently in the field of ideas. And, of course, the important thing is that there have been many books that have demonstrated the more guns you have, the less crime. And when you're in a state where the people have a right to carry, what right to carry is a right of the people, and they have a right to carry a concealed weapon, the incidence of crime goes down, doesn't it, Howard? What did you find out about the right to carry states?
Well, yeah, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me.
Well, just give us a
rough. But the average, if you aggregate the 2006 FBI violent crime data, you find that the right to carry states have about a 30% lower violent crime rate, 25 to 30% lower violent crime rate than the states that ban their citizens from carrying concealed. And not only that, but the right to carry states have about a 30 to 40% lower homicide rate than the states without right to carry. So of course, every time a state passes right to carry, the gun ban hysteria comes up, and they say the same thing every time, that there will be blood in the streets, shootouts, over parking lots at the mall, etc., etc. People can't handle this responsibility. There's going to be an increase in death. Well, then kindly explain to me why the right to carry states have such a lower violent crime and homicide rate.
And, of course, it's because a criminal doesn't want to get shot. You know, we need to have the right to carry arms here in California because of the increasing gun violence. And, you know, certainly you'd hate to think that you need a gun to protect yourself and your family. But certainly in a city like Salinas, and even increasingly in a nice, quiet suburban community like mine, we need guns to protect ourselves from these violent gangs who think nothing at all of killing people. In fact, they're always going around killing people. The number of murders over in Salinas or shootings in Salinas gang-related are really frightening. I would never thought that in the area where I live here in the Monterey Bay area that we'd ever see these violent gangs, but they're certainly there, aren't they?
Well, the I-5 corridor is a real conduit, and what people don't seem to understand is if gangs are successful at smuggling drugs in, what makes you think they won't be just as successful in smuggling guns, which is what's been shown in the United Kingdom? The other thing is, especially living away from an urban area, is when you call 911, how long is it going to take for them to patch you into the right law enforcement department, and how long is it going to take for them to dispatch somebody? As it's said quite often, when seconds count, the police are only minutes away. And in some cases, they're 30 minutes away. One time when I was on a business trip in California, I see the signs up there now say, you know, call 911, call the CHP if you see somebody driving erratically. We want to get drunk drivers off the road. So I did that. And I got put through voicemail hell until it hung up on me. So much for California 911. And this is something that, even a lot of people who support our Bill of Rights and our constitutional foundation don't know, and that's that the Supreme Court and all the other higher level courts have consistently ruled that the police do not have any obligation to come out and try to protect you. They do not have an obligation to protect any particular member of society. If you get shot, well, that's too bad. And I cite some cases, in one case where a woman had a restraining order against her violent ex-husband. She believed that gave her a special relationship with the police. The Supreme Court said, no, that's not true. The lower courts actually said that, well, you know, yeah, the police department's liable. They should have known that this was a dangerous situation. They should have been there because the guy came and kidnapped her kids and murdered them. But the Supreme Court, which is what it's always found, is that, no, that's not true. The police do not have an obligation, so they reversed the lower court ruling, and she was left with three dead kids and legal fees. And that's that. And there's case after case. I cite a few of them in the book.
Yeah, I think you do a very, very good job. There's a lot of great information in the book, and certainly you've done a great job of putting it all together, but mainly the fact that in other countries where they've outlawed, you know, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, it has increased the violent crimes considerably. Now, certainly we have a fairly high homicide rate in America. It's unfortunate, but I think there's probably racial problems there that we're in specific races, Hispanic and blacks, there's probably more people killing them within the races themselves than the whites. If we just took the whites, why, we'd find that this is not a factor. And I'm not saying that, I think you have to understand that we get into water fluoridation, and of course the fact that when you fluoridate the water, why you increase the amount of lead in the blood, sixth-fold increase of lead in blacks. And of course, this leads to rage and irresponsible behavior, and they know that. And yet they insist on fluoridating the water with hydrofluorosilicic acid that contains lead and cadmium and arsenic and polonium. And they know the effect it has on the mind of the blacks. And this is, I believe, really one of the reasons we have this as a problem. But that's a whole different subject. That's Roger Masters' work back at Dartmouth. And anybody wants information on it, we have our interviews with Roger Masters, who's a professor at Dartmouth, concerned about why certain racial groups, you know, assume to be so much more prone to violence. These are scientific facts, but of course, and this is one of the largest studies ever done on 450,000 children, the blood of 450,000 children. But you're not going to hear this discussed by Rush Limbaugh or by Sean Hannity. Well, certainly, what sort of response have you gotten from the people who have read your book, Howard?
Well, so far it's been positive, but you know, the funny thing is, if somebody hated what they read, they probably wouldn't talk to me. But I've gotten some good reviews from people. Jerry Patterson, our land commissioner, he liked it. Some of the stalwarts of the Second Amendment scholars like Don Cates and Dave Koppel, who've been instrumental in our 25-year now restoration of the Second Amendment. I've gotten some good press, and I've gotten a lot of people interested in getting a copy of the book. It's all fairly new to me. It's my first book.
Well, don't feel bad. I'll tell you what. It's sort of exciting, and don't get discouraged. They're hard to get books distributed, but the best way to do it is through talk radio. And if I don't call you, you be sure to call me. We'll get you on our other networks, because I think your book is well worthwhile talking about, and, of course, getting the people informed so that they can counter the fallacious arguments are used by the fascist element within our society that wants to take away our ability to defend ourselves, not only from criminals, but from the excesses of government, because that is the greatest murder of modern times. And during the 20th century, far more people died from government than have died throughout all the centuries before that from wars and other things. Unbelievable, but true, unfortunately. Well, certainly right now we've got Jack calling from Michigan. Jack, do you have a question for our guest?
Yes, Dr. Stan. The 1968 Gun Act, being a word-for-word carbon copy of the Nazi Gun Act of 1938.
You're talking about the Gun Act that was enacted by Senator Dodd at the time, who just went out, got the Nazi Gun Act, and then had to pass in the federal government. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, he lifted it from the Nuremberg war trial, and I saw it in Guns and Ammo, May of 93. JPFO was the one that generated the article in Guns and Ammo, May. I wanted to ask the guest why he thinks the United States government adopted that, and whether all subsequent gun acts are predicated upon that.
You know anything about that act that was passed back, I guess, in the late 60s, where basically they just took almost word for word the Nazi Gun Act and enacted it into law here in the United States?
Yeah, I haven't researched that yet. I've had so much to research.
I know. Of course,
as far as the second part of the question, yes, it does appear that all gun laws are predicated upon that, because the enactment of the 1968 Gun Control Act made it, quote, reasonable, unquote, to pass gun control laws.
Right.
So if you listen to the rhetoric from the anti-rights organizations, you will find that every time they propose a new gun control law, it is a reasonable law. So yes, there is a relationship. And, you know, that's why, and I also see that this gun control has been an incremental process, actually since the 1930s, when they passed the Firearms Act that banned civilians from owning automatic weapons, like a machine gun. So it's been an incremental process. And we're involved in an incremental process of turning that around. I kind of see it as a very large ocean-going ship. You don't flip it on a dime and start going in the other direction. It takes time. It takes effort. And one of the reasons I wrote this book is because I wanted to get more tools into the hands of good people so that they are empowered to be better able to convince other people that we need to turn this around and we need to restore the Second Amendment.
And I think you're absolutely right. That information came from the Jews for the preservation of the right to keep and bear firearms. And a very, very good patriotic American Jewish person heads that group. Anything else you want to say, Jack, before we let you go?
You handle this gentleman's book, right, Dr. Stan?
No, we're not. At least we're not handling it at the present time, but you can get it through that telephone number if you'd like to. And again, the number to call if you want to get the book would be 562-925-0652. That's 562-925-0652.
Thank you, Dr. Stan.
God bless. Thanks very much. That was Jack calling from Michigan. If you're out there and you have a question.
Yeah. Thank you for your question, Jack.
Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, and certainly Jack's point is well made. I don't think most Americans know that there is a close relationship between current American law and current Nazi law, but then, of course, most people don't understand the spiritual forces that energize the Nazis are the same spiritual forces that energize people working within our government. And, of course, certainly our good friend Jim Mars is coming out with a new book on the Nazi connection and the relationship, of course, between key people in our government and the Nazi movement. Most people don't understand that it was American banks and corporations that financed and subsidized Adolf Hitler, not only before the Second World War, but during the Second World War. And until people really began to understand something about history, that's covered in a book called The Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, which we do carry. That's Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, which we carry. And then Trading with the Enemy by Charles Hingham, H-I-N-G-H-A-M, which is out of print, which we do not carry. But, of course, it would be very embarrassing for people to understand that the grandfather of the current President of the United States, his law firm was indicted for helping the Nazis during the Second World War. That was Senator Prescott Bush. But, of course, we never talk about that. You can check it out up on the Internet. And I really believe, of course, that there are powerful spiritual forces at work working to disarm the American people. Well, certainly, are there any other points you'd like to make, Howard?
I think along the lines of what you're saying, I think any student of history, whether for good or bad, will understand, as Santayana said, you know, those who don't study history are doomed to repeat it. I also believe that a lot of these people who are high up in the government are fairly intelligent, and they probably do study history, and maybe they intend to repeat it. It's pretty obvious that the gun control formula has been successful in the past. So for somebody in this day and age to want to repeat it, the formula is already laid out. All they have to do is put it in action.
Well, I think it's important that people understand that what we're seeing is like deja vu all over again. There's nothing new about this, but there are people who really have a different worldview who want to control your life from the cradle to the grave. Well, now we have 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program, Howard. So what's the message you'd like to leave with our listeners out across America?
Another reason I wrote this book is because I wanted to reach out to people who, like me, probably believe that gun control is a good idea. I want you to understand the underlying reasons why self-defense is important, and I also want you to understand what the underlying reasons why I've come to disagree with the people who are proponents of gun control. I've done 3.5 years of research. I started out agreeing with them wholeheartedly. What I found disturbed me greatly. I decided to do something about it, and I started writing research. This book is the result of that. I really am trying to reach out to you and help you understand better some of the more subtle and powerful undercurrents that are governing your life, especially as we're coming up on this election season. I want you to think about what's important to you and your family, and I'd really love to have you read this book, get a better understanding of what's going on, and maybe you will even begin to change your mind, and hopefully you'll do it before you cast your vote in November.
Well, I do believe it, Chris. This is a very, very important issue. I believe that it shouldn't either. In fact, this is one of the big reasons that we got Republicans elected in the past, was because they, you know, they supported the right of the people to keep and bear arms. Now, of course, there's some of the people who pretend to be Republicans who make that statement. They really don't believe it, but there are others who really do believe, as you and I do, that the right of the people to be armed certainly preserves our freedom. In fact, there are those who say that the Founding Fathers put the Second Amendment in the Bill of Rights to protect the other 9 rights that are outlawed in the Bill of Rights, because they knew that only an armed populace would be able to counter the avarice of government, that government always wants to expand its power over the lives of the people. And this, of course, was the secret of America. We were to be a nation where the power of the central authority was to be limited over the lives of the people. But how would you possibly be able to enforce the laws of our land if our populace were disarmed and we had neoconservatives who were really Trotskyites controlling, certainly working within both political parties in Washington, D.C.? They work out of the American Enterprise Institute, and they are some of the most powerful people in America. In fact, one of them today, one of the neoconservatives who are Trotskyites, is the Vice President of the United States. His name is Dick Cheney. And you really need, of course, to read my newsletters to understand their philosophy. God bless you, Howard. Thanks so very much. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we do hope that you enjoyed our program with Howard this evening, and that you'll certainly give serious consideration to this issue of the right of the people to keep and bear arms, and the importance of the Second Amendment to the Constitution. So certainly we have a number of programs on gun control. We really should put together a 4-tape set on that. If you'd like to get a copy of the talk we had tonight, you get it either on audio tape or CD. And of course, we talked during the during the intermissions, during the commercials, so you'll get a lot of information you did not hear on this program. If you'd like to get a tape, the number to call is 1-800-544-8927. Now, for an understanding, certainly, of the background of the neoconservative movement, You certainly will want to read my May newsletter, not out yet, but the May Radio Liberty newsletter will be going out very, very soon, and of course it gives you tremendous insight into why things are happening as they are in America today, who the neoconservatives are, what their relationship is to the philosophy of Plato and Machiavelli, and certainly Michael Ledeen. And Michael Ledeen is one of the key leaders in the neoconservative movement, which advocates the philosophies of Plato and of Machiavelli. And both men believed in a dictatorship. And the people in the neoconservative movements are Trotskyites. They're an elite who want to rule our nation. And believe me, their people are planted in every key the division of our government today. If you'd like to go to their website, it's called newamericancentury.org. They are the ones who put together the project for the New American Century and planned the war with Iraq long before it ever began. Again, the website, www.newamericancentury.org. Then, of course, we want to, of course, remind our leaders, our listeners, that if you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, or watch the DVD, you really should do it. Now, if you can't afford the DVD, why, go to our website at radioliberty.com, and the talk is recorded there, called The Brotherhood of Darkness. You'll certainly want to go to our website and look at the not only the regular DVDs, but the new ones my son has posted up there. They are very important DVDs, and we're hoping to get up a lot more that will help you to understand what is really going on in our country today. Certainly, you need, of course, to get the DVDs we offer on They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll, because, of course, many people within the music industry have made a pact with the devil. And, of course, once you've seen those DVDs, the 3-hour or the 10-hour version, you will realize, of course, that that many of our people in politics have made exactly the same deal that the people in the music industry have made. They've sold their souls to the dark side, to the prince of this world. You'll certainly want to get the DVDs, The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning, the DVD, The Riddles in Stone. You'll want to get the DVD on the Atlantis Connection, because, of course, America is the new Atlantis that is to lead this whole world into the new world order and the new world religion. And then, of course, let me suggest the DVD on the emergence. It's important that you understand the emergence, because, of course, this is the coming world leader, and this is a talk that's given by Constance Cumby. All of these and so much more is available by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927, or certainly, and we do hope that you'll want to get the information. You can go to our website at radioliberty.com. You can listen to our programs there. Our live feed to satellite 9 hours a day. You can hear our programs 5 hours a day, 4 hours certainly on our website, another hour at americannewsnet.com. Our job is to educate you so that when I'm not here, you'll be able to educate others. And we're involved truly in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. And you have to learn how to verbalize this, how to convince people that there really is a spiritual battle taking place. So again, please go to our website at radioliberty.com, our number 1-800-544-8927, and then please pray for America. Pray for revival, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.
evening, ladies and gentlemen. Wherever you're situated on this great, big, beautiful blue globe, floating through the point of Yah's creation, it is Monday, and here we are into the sixth month of the year. It's the 2nd of June already. Well, here we go, marching towards the summer. And Joyce and I, we had ourselves a little bit of an experience this past weekend.